Thank you, Christine. Our next speaker is Mark Lemley. Mark is the William H. Newcomb Professor of Law at Stanford Law School, the Director of the Stanford Program in Law, Science, and Technology, and the Director of Stanford's LLM Program in Law, Science, and Technology. He teaches intellectual property, computer and internet program in law, science, and technology, computer and internet law, patent law, and antitrust. He is of counsel to the law firm of Kiker and Van Nest. Mark?
Thanks. Actually, you can leave the lights on because uncharacteristically, I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. I realize that's shocking. Thank you. All right, so normally when I've given this paper in the past, I have been talking to a bunch of patent lawyers and trying to tell people who know a lot about the patent system and nothing about nanotechnology what nanotechnology is, and is it or is it not a lot of hype? I take it that I don't have to discuss either of those issues with respect to you. Instead, my job here is the reversed. I've got to tell a bunch of technologists what the patent system is and whether it is or is not a lot of hype. The hype in patents and nanotechnology is backed up by a rather sobering reality. And to start the discussion of that reality, I want to sort of start out by telling you what's happening in the patent world. I think you can actually get an excellent sense of the role of patents in nanotechnology if you take a look here at the board, which by my count has 8 technology companies, a VC firm, a couple of foundations, and 8 law firms sponsoring this conference. Right now, innately generous people as we lawyers are, that's not an accident, right? Those people are sponsoring the conference. They're sponsoring nanotechnology quite generally because they see something very significant for their business here, which is a massive wave in the patenting of nanotechnology. So let me give you some data on this point. Bhavin Sampat at Columbia did a study in which he studied just patents issued in the United States covering nanotechnology between the years 2001 and 2003, only 3 years worth. And he found 3,700 patents covering nanotechnological inventions. That substantially understates the true impact of the patent system on nanotechnology for a variety of reasons. Right. First off, he used a very conservative definition. He excluded a number of things that might bring in non-nanotech inventions. He required the use of particular terms in patent claims. And one of the things we know from patenting new technologies in the future is people don't always standardize on technology in the patent literature. And there may be a number of stealth patents out there that cover nanotechnology, but that we just don't know about yet. Second, of course, it's only the United States. Third, it didn't include 2004. If you replicate the numbers adding in 2004, you're up to 5,600 patents issued just this millennium, just in the first 4 years on nanotechnological inventions. More significantly, it takes about 3 years on average for a patent application to get through the patent office, which means that all of the patents in Bhavin Sampat's study were patents filed on inventions made in the last millennium. Right? They don't include any of the patents that have been filed that are going to turn out in the next couple of years to be issued on inventions that are being made right now. We can get one brief window into that by looking at newly published patent applications, and those newly published patent applications are actually quite significant. They're in the range of 3,800 a year being published, suggesting we're on an upward curve, maybe even a near exponential growth curve in nanotech patents, notwithstanding the existence of a rather significant economic recession in the early part of this decade. Right? other perhaps even better indicators. One of my personal favorite indicators is, of course, the law firms. No fewer than 12 law firms have official nanotechnology groups. Right, that is, they've employed they've taken an entire group like litigation or corporate tax. They've identified nanotechnology as a law firm long-term business, something they're going to be involved in the future. And virtually all of those groups are entirely devoted to patents. Right, there isn't a lot of nanotech litigation groups out there or nanotech environmental groups out there. These are patent lawyers. The Patent Office, which is notorious for following sometimes by decades behind the actual technological trends, it was the mid-1990s when they acknowledged that computer software was actually an area of technology, has identified nanotechnology as a new class for which it's defined a new group bringing together all of the nanotechnology inventions. That's, I think, again, a following, not a leading indicator. And when you go beyond the numbers and you look at the specific patents that are out there, you find something quite remarkable. Not surprisingly, like with any other area of technology, a lot of these patents are incremental improvements on particular technologies that were already out there, right? Shrinking of semiconductor inventions into the submicron level and some of the implications of that. But there are a big chunk of nanotechnology patents that are on the basic building blocks of nanotechnology. Right. My favorite example is carbon nanotubes. Carbon nanotubes are, of course, a very potentially useful technology. You probably won't be too surprised to know that they're patented. You might be surprised to know that there are over 300 patents on carbon nanotubes, including 10 that claim the basic technology itself, that just flat overlap. Right? They can't all have invented carbon nanotubes. Another 20 that claim methods of producing carbon nanotubes. Maybe there are, in fact, 20 different methods of producing them, though I'm skeptical. Again, I suspect we got substantial overlap. And then another 250 or so on uses of carbon nanotubes. Right? And those actually could all be 250 different uses if we think people have so far thought of 250 different uses for carbon nanotubes that they've reduced to practice sufficiently to put them in the form of a patent application. But there are plenty of other examples, too. There were multiple patents on semiconductor nanocrystals. There are patents on chemical vapor deposition processes. There were patents on various transition metal oxides, on scanning probe microscopes, atomic force microscopes, various forms of self-assembly, light-emitting nanocrystals, right? Basic building block patents. Now, what I want to suggest to you is that for a variety of reasons, nanotechnology is unique or almost unique in the patent system. The role of patents are going to be greater in nanotechnology than they've been in virtually any other technology in our memory. First, and perhaps shockingly, this is the first of what I would call an enabling technologies, right? Not just a sort of new invention, but a kind of something that opens up whole new fields that has broad possible applications. The first one in 80 or maybe even 100 years in which the basic building blocks were all patented, and those patents were owned by a bunch of different people. For one reason or another, and it really is a series of historical accidents, in virtually every other significant new field of technology in the last century, the patents either haven't been filed because the things weren't patentable. That was true of software and the internet in its very early days, because the people involved just decided they didn't want patents, right? Tim Berners-Lee and the World Wide Web, because they forgot. Right, Atanasoff and his story of the computer in 1942, we meant to get around to it. We actually called a patent lawyer, but you know, there was a war on and we were busy and it just never happened. Kohler and Milstein with monoclonal antibodies, where the British National Research and Development Council concluded that there were no plausible economic applications for monoclonal antibodies, and so it wasn't worth patenting. or technologies in which patents did happen, but for one reason or another, they didn't actually end up looming over a nascent industry. So think here of the transistor or IBM's basic inventions in the computer, which are patented, but they're patented by companies that are at the time under government regulation, antitrust consent decrees that either prevent them from getting into the market at all or allow or require them to license on sub-market rates, and so they freely pass the invention around to the world. Or they're inventions that occur at universities in the 1970s, at times when universities either didn't patent at all, case of DNA, or filed patent applications but then were coerced by the National Institutes of Health into licensing them to all comers on fairly liberal terms, so that even some of the basic biotechnology patents, like the work of Cohen and Boyer, which generate substantial revenue for the universities, right, generate that revenue without interfering with anybody's ability to use the basic technology. We even have a bunch of technologies in which the fundamental building blocks get patented, but because of disputes over who's the first inventor, those patents languish in the patent system for 15, 20, even 30 years before they actually ever get issued and enforced. And that turns out to be the case in lasers, turns out to be the case in integrated circuits, and in polymer chemistry. And in all of those cases, ultimately there was a patent, but at the formative period of the technology, we didn't have patents on the basic building blocks. We did, of course, get lots and lots of patents in many of these industries on applications, on improvements, on implementations of those building blocks, but the building blocks themselves stayed open. In fact, the one kind of enabling technology you can think of that in recent memory that doesn't fit this model is xerography. Xerox actually did end up holding patents on the basic building blocks of the technology, but because it was the only company, because there were no competitors in the field, the patents were all concentrated in one source, right? And so Xerox was actually free to make whatever inventions it wanted during the course of that technology. It didn't have to worry about other people out there holding conflicting rights. There weren't 10 different inventors. You got to go back to, I think, radio and maybe the airplane to get circumstances that look like what's shaping up in nanotechnology. A basic technology at which, from the very outset, people start filing applications on the very basic building blocks, on the very basic ideas, and different people end up owning those rights, right? So that they overlap, they come into conflict. And we'll talk a little bit about what that example might mean in a minute. Second effect that makes patents particularly interesting in the nanotech sphere is the cross-industry or potential cross-industry structure of nanotechnology. Right? We're used to dealing with patents in silos. The semiconductor folks have semiconductor patents, and the biotech folks have biotech patents, and the material science folks have material science patents, and they deal with each other with respect to those patents. We don't have nearly as well established a technological or licensing architecture for dealing with circumstances in which a patent that might be owned by a biotech company has significant implications, not just for biotechnology, but for semiconductor design or materials science or textile manufacturing or a variety of other things. Right? That doesn't mean that we can't develop those licensing mechanisms, but it means that companies are going to have to start dealing with patent owners in fields that they've never had to deal with before. And the fact that there are nanotechnology patents in 253 different patent classes suggests some of the scope of this problem. Third thing that's different about nanotech patents, and this might actually turn out to be the most significant, is the role of university ownership of patenting. Right. Universities traditionally weren't really in the business of patents. It wasn't until 1980 when we passed the Bayh-Dole Act and said you can get federal funding and still apply for patents in your own right that universities started to patent. And the result is universities have been a lot more active in the last 25 years. 16 times as many university patents in 2004 as there were in 1980, right? 16 times. But even that 16 times is a pretty small percentage of total patents. It's only about 1% of total United States patents that are owned by universities today. So they're more active, but they're still a niche player. But in nanotech, that number is not 1%, it is 13%. Right? There are 13 times as many university patents in nanotech as in other industries. And that's because, I think, right, so much of the patenting is occurring at the early stage. It's occurring at the basic building blocks that you associate with a lot of university invention. Right? That means that a lot of the people who are going to be holding rights in these technologies are not commercial entities whose incentives we know and understand. They're universities. Right? Now, if you put all this stuff together, right, the patenting by multiple entities of all these basic building blocks, the fact that they may cross industry boundaries and indeed cross industry university boundaries, I think what you see is that patents are casting or will cast a larger shadow over nanotechnology than over any other industry in living memory. Now, that shadow could be a good one or a bad one. Right? Nanotechnology, it requires substantial innovation and investment, and patents are a significant driver of that substantial innovation and investment. Right? And particularly in technologies where startup companies need financial support, right, it is important that they actually get the benefit of the patent system. But one of the lessons we've learned in industries in which we have lots of different patents that overlap and are owned by different people is that patents can not only promote innovation, they can also interfere with innovation. And that happens in particular when we create what we call patent thickets, right? Worlds in which so many people own so many different rights that clearing all of those rights becomes difficult, if not impossible. And anybody who manufactures semiconductors understands the nature of the problem. The problem is one in which your invention isn't covered by a patent or even five patents. It's covered by 500 or 1,000 or even 5,000 patents. And when that happens, people panic, right? They try to do one of a couple of things. One is they try to go out and get licenses if they can get those licenses in bulk. There's no plausible way that they can get those licenses at a retail level, right? Not only because the transactions costs are enormous, find 5,000 patent owners and sign deals with them, but because what economists call the double marginalization problem and patent lawyers call the royalty stacking problem, right? Each of these people says, I've got a right to prevent you from selling your product. So I'm going to demand a disproportionate share of the royalties associated with that product in order to let you produce it. And when you get enough people, each of whom says, I'm going to demand a certain percentage, you rapidly accelerate to impossibility. There are plenty of examples of this in the modern world. My personal favorite is third generation wireless technology in Europe, where a standard setting organization put out a call for essential patents. Please give us only those patents essential to the technology without which you can't do 3G wireless. And just the people who responded, this isn't all patent owners, these are just the ones who voluntarily came in and said, yes, I have one, and here's what I will offer to license it at. The licensing rates came in at 135% total. Right? Now, it's awfully hard to make money if you're paying out 135% of everything you take in just in licensing fees before you start manufacturing anything. Right? So we need ways to try to solve that problem. One way you can try to solve that problem is cross-licensing. Right? I've got a bunch of patents. You've got a bunch of patents. We could, in fact, assert them against each other, but then we're both in trouble. Where you've got that symmetrical relationship, right, cross-licensing seems to work, and that happens a lot in the semiconductor industry, in the telecommunications industry, and so forth. Those cross-licenses are often on $0 terms, that is, we'll just agree not to sue each other, or maybe they're for relatively small numbers. But the system breaks down where the parties owning patents are not in a symmetric relationship with the parties who need the patent licenses. Right? So if I am a non-manufacturing entity, all I do is own patents. Right? Or if I'm a small company in one field, but I have rights that cover something somebody else is doing in another field, there's no symmetry, there's no mutually assured destruction, and so there's no basis for a royalty-free cross-license. Instead, what these people are going to want primarily is money. What's interesting and I think potentially problematic is that the largest entities that are in that situation are the universities. And universities, right, with the best of motives, right, we want to fund education and research, right, have discovered patents as a revenue mechanism, right? They've discovered in an era of declining governmental support, in an era of increasing costs, that here's a free chunk of money. Right, and the free chunk of money comes at the expense of the people who are going to have to use this technologies. Universities aren't likely in a position that we can cross license. Right, we are instead going to try to maximize revenue. One of the ways you maximize revenue in the ordinary university patent license is you make sure that your patent licenses are exclusive rather than non-exclusive. For reasons that ought to be obvious, if you think about it, you get a higher royalty rate on an exclusive patent than you do on a non-exclusive patent. So if you're in a university licensing office, right, the natural thing to do is take the 6% exclusive royalty rate, not the 2% non-exclusive royalty rate when the deal is offered to you. That's what seems to maximize the revenue. It may not maximize the revenue in the long run if what we're talking about is a basic building block technology. Right? Because we may actually be in a world in which, right, letting everyone use a carbon nanotube for a relatively low rate actually generates more total revenue, even for the university, than saying, no, one company and only one company is going to get the license or the rights to do that thing. And that's especially true if different people are making similar decisions, right? If there are 10 carbon nanotube patents, and each one is granted on an exclusive basis to some company, well, unless they all happen to go to the same company, we're going to have a rather serious problem of conflict or overlap between those patents. Now, the examples I gave in which we've had a similar situation, radio and airplanes, are not so encouraging. We had hundreds of patents in both cases, owned by different entities. They got into extensive patent wars that substantially delayed the development of the technology. And it was not until in both cases the government stepped in and said, you will all get together and cross-license your patents. In airplanes during the context of World War I, when the government wanted advances in airplane technology, and in radio with the creation of RCA, that we solved this problem. You could draw the lesson from that we need the similar intervention in nanotechnology. I'm skeptical of drawing that lesson, right? I think there are possible private solutions to this. Standard-setting organizations, cross-licenses can help to deal with this problem. Maybe just ignoring them and hoping they'll go away will help to deal with this problem. We do that somewhat in the semiconductor industry, right? Nobody does a patent search in the semiconductor industry. You'd have to be crazy to do so, because you're going to find things that are going to alarm you. The one thing we do know about nanotechnology is that it's small, right? It may actually be that some nanotechnology applications are relatively easy to hide. Infringement is hard to detect. So we might get by through a system of some licenses, some cross-licenses, some standard-setting organizations that pre-commit to openness, some infringement that nobody finds out about, and some patent lawsuits and some people being shut down. Right, and we don't know yet, right? This is a story that doesn't have an ending because we don't know yet sort of how bad the system is going to be. But I can tell you that there are, in fact, indications that you're going to spend a substantial chunk of your life in the next 20 years thinking about patents and patent lawyers, whether you like it or not. And on that perhaps depressing note, I guess I will end.
I found the book Owning the Future by Seth Shulman entertaining and alarming. Do you have recommendations for a general introduction on this issue of patenting and IP?
Right. It depends on the level at which you want a general introduction. I mean, I think there are writings on this issue from various different perspectives. Rivette and Klein have a book on sort of the untapped value of patents from a very pro-patent perspective. This is obviously a book that has a somewhat different perspective. I would say, I also got, and you're welcome to have it, I mean, I've got a sort of short by legal standards article, which is 30 pages. Actually, that's stunningly short by legal standards. It doesn't even qualify as an article in legal journals. But on the issues of patenting nanotechnology, that details some of the things that I've talked about in greater detail, and I'm happy to send it to anybody who wants it. Let's stop there.
We give up. We surrender. Just give us somebody to surrender to, will
right.
you?
Well, the problem is you're going to have no shortage of people to surrender to, right? If there was a single person you could surrender to, the problem would be a lot simpler than it is, right? What you see in the IT industries is a sort of endless stream of people who pop up after a technology's been marketed, right, and say, hey, I own a piece of this. I invented this 10 years ago, or I bought this patent from someone who invented it 10 years ago. So that's a potential problem. Now, there are ways to deal with that problem that are not nanotech ways. The Congress is working right now on various aspects of patent reform, and this problem of holdup and patent thickets is one of the issues that's being discussed. There are ways you can make the problem less bad. Right, you can sort of get rid of some of the incentives to engage in, to demand more money than your share, to engage in these holdup activities. There isn't in fact a good surrender.
I wonder if it's possible that for over here.
Hi.
Does the government and funding agencies recognize the difference between the airplane and radio times and now because of the university patents? And I wonder if there's any leverage that could be applied to increase
yep.
funding to decrease this mm-hmm. need to mm-hmm. soak as much money you can out of your patents.
There is. When we created the Bayh-Dole Act in 1980, we created a government march-in right. So the government actually has the right to come in and compel a university or anybody else who created an invention with federal funding to license it for a royalty, rather than to kind of hold up and say no one can use it, or to demand a royalty of whatever price they think is appropriate. The government has never used that right. It threatened to in the context of the Cipro patent right after the anthrax scare in 2002, and the threat was very effective. Bayer dropped its price by 90%. So there is, in fact, in the law a mechanism that at least for the subset of patents that are government funded, which might be in the building block context the ones you're most concerned about, would allow us to clear out a circumstance in which that a patent owner of an essential patent had just said, I'm not going to license anybody, or I'm only going to license this one person. But whether the government will do that, I'm somewhat skeptical of.
One more question, because we're going to go to a panel and do a whole panel.
My question is about wasn't there a recent court decision by the Supreme Court or some court close to that universities have to pay patent royalties for inventions that are used in the course of their research that they then obtained other patents, and doesn't that kind of level the field to some extent?
Yeah, it might. It's a good point, right? So yes, the federal circuit, there, everybody sort of thought, at least in the university community, in the academic community, there was an experimental use exception that said if you're just experimenting, you're okay. The federal circuit essentially eliminated it in the Mady versus Duke University case a couple of years ago. And so universities, even if they're just doing experimentation in the laboratory, right, may end up having to pay royalties. That might actually put them in a more symmetric relationship, which I think is what you're suggesting, right, and helps to solve the problem. Though, again, I think it turns out to be harder to detect whether you're infringing some particular patents at the experimentation stage. It's much easier to detect once you get out into products. Very few universities have been sued so far for patent infringement since that change in the law, but it is a possibility, and if a university is being particularly aggressive in asserting its own rights, one of the things it might expect back in the new environment are some patent claims against itself. That's a good point.
Great. Let's go to our panel.
Okay. So we're going to do a panel on this, and
could I ask our panelists to join us here?